I'm Kim Norberg, IJ's Director of Donor Communications. Before the break, Jeff, Anthony, and Rob shared some great insights into how courts think about constitutional rights. And so we're now going to explore how IJ turns that theory into action. We're going to do that in the context of four emerging property rights issues: the Fourth Amendment, zoning, government evictions, and predictive policing. These are all relatively new areas for IJ, but they grew out of work that we've been doing for a long time. Things like eminent domain, civil forfeiture, fines and fees, things that you've been hearing about throughout the weekend. And as this work has evolved, property rights has become IJ's largest and most varied litigation pillar. The breadth and depth of our work in this space makes sense. Private property rights are the foundation of a free society, and yet governments are constantly encroaching on those rights. So this morning, I'm going to bring up a few IJ attorneys and clients so that you can hear directly from the people who are enforcing these rights in court. We'll start with the Fourth Amendment, and I'll talk with IJ client Alex Schott from Texas and IJ senior attorney Rob Frommer, who leads our project on the Fourth Amendment.
Each step along the way, not just the officers, but his manager calling me, the internal affairs department, they all trashed everything and said everything was justified. I haven't done anything wrong.
So, Alec, that's you, obviously, in that video
yes.
that we just saw. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, I do a lot of work in oil and gas, so we help customers reduce their emissions, so I travel all over the state. And I was driving home one day from a customer visit and minding my own business, passed a police officer on the side of the road, and he immediately pulled me over and said I was drifting over the fog line. And I was immediately asked to get out of my car, and he said I was going to get a warning, and he said, would you mind coming and sitting inside my vehicle with me? And I thought it was extremely strange. It was not the normal license and registration. It was weird that he was offering a warning and then wanting me to get out of my truck. So I proceeded to go with him. He asked to pat me down to sit inside his vehicle. I knew something was wrong. But when someone has a badge and a gun, you don't have a lot of options.
Yeah.
So I sat in the vehicle with him, and he kind of ran my license, and which, you know, only shows a few speeding tickets over the years. And he proceeded to go on and interrogate me about my vehicle, my travels. He didn't like my story that I was traveling for work and that I was visiting a customer.
Yeah, because who does that?
Yeah.
And He didn't understand the complications of my work, which was not a big deal. So I just said, did oil field work. And so he printed my warning, and then he immediately asked if he could search my car. And I said, no, you may not. And he said, well, that's fine. I'm going to call in a drug dog.
Yeah. And you have body cam footage of this, right? We have this video on YouTube. And so you weren't even drifting over the fog line. And so he just kind of made this up to stop you.
Yeah, he made up a random reason to pull me over, which I was fairly certain I hadn't drifted. But when someone says you're going to get a warning, you're kind of relieved that it's not a speeding ticket. So I kind of just went along with it because I didn't have a choice. But I clearly knew something was wrong in the situation. So he proceeded to hold me there and make me wait for a drug dog to arrive. Later, through video evidence, it turns out that the drug handling dog handler, he signaled the dog to alert on my truck. And that proceeded into a full vehicle search for my vehicle for 45 minutes with three officers.
And he eventually told you kind of the real reason why he pulled you over, right? What did he say?
Yeah. So before the drug dog arrived, he said, I'm out here looking for big shit. He said, I'm not a patrol officer. He's basically looking for drugs and human trafficking. And I said, oh, that Sure, that's fantastic.
Yeah. And as Rob is indicating, as we heard yesterday, money also. So Rob, when exactly did this whole situation become unconstitutional?
Oh my God, this was unconstitutional from the start. Again, we talked a little bit about that video, which I really recommend everybody go on YouTube and watch. Because when you look at it, you can clearly see Alec never crosses the fog line. The officer didn't have any reasonable suspicion to stop Alex. He just made it up. And once that happened, everything started going downhill. I mean, think about it. Al got pulled into the officer's vehicle. He got interrogated with the officer fishing for crimes. He gets this warning, and then the officer forces him to sit there for 20 minutes until a drug dog comes. And to top it off, just like you heard, right before that dog goes, yip, the handler does this little cue. Everything about this stop from start to finish was unconstitutional.
And this isn't the first time that we've encountered Fourth Amendment issues in our work, right? So how did the project on the Fourth Amendment at IJ, how did that start?
Well, IJ is only about 30 years old, but the principles that motivate our Fourth Amendment work are much older. Okay, go back to the American Revolution. In the Revolutionary War, one of the major reasons that we fought that was because of the threats that were posed to our security and our persons and property. Back then, they had this thing called a general warrant. It was just a blank piece of paper that let officers enter into private residences at will. And now, that probably sounds terrible to you, because the idea here in America, just as it was back then and just as it was in England, is that our home is our castle. And it's that principle that motivates our work. That's why we've always fought against eminent domain abuse. That's why we have always fought to protect the rights of tenants from having officials barge into their homes without consent or a warrant. But unfortunately, these kinds of abuses take place, as we can see, far away from the home. I had a case in Chicago, for instance. In Chicago, the city actually required all the food trucks to carry GPS tracking devices so that they could root out any illegal competition. And, you know, over and over again, we see that many of the civil forfeiture cases and many of the fines and fees cases begin with bogus traffic stops, like what happened to Alec. Dana yesterday talked about Brookside, Alabama. That was a town where they created an entire program of predatory and reasonable stops that was designed to separate people from their cars and their cash. So as we started seeing all this, we stepped back and we realized what a big enabler of this abuse was what the courts had done to the Fourth Amendment. As you've heard from other speakers, the courts are supposed to be the bulwark of our rights. They're supposed to be the protectors of our rights. But instead, in the name of quote-unquote efficient policing, they turned our rights under the Fourth Amendment to a little more than Swiss cheese. So we analyzed the problems, came up with our own plan about how the Fourth Amendment should be adopted and implemented, and we launched the program back in 2021.
And as part of that project, obviously, we have Alec's case in Bexar County where this happened. So, Alec, are you worried that what happens to you is going to happen again?
Not only am I worried for myself, but for others, but it actually did happen again. I proceeded after that. I still had to travel for work, so I started renting vehicles when traveling through that county so my vehicle wasn't tagged. Through their license plate recognition system that turns out they were using. And so I started renting vehicles, and then I was pulled over without cause for being in a rental, because that was suspicious. So I can't drive my truck. I can't drive a rental car. So it's apparently illegal to drive in Texas.
Yeah, nobody goes to work, and nobody rents cars. Apparently, suspicious behavior. So, Rob, this is obviously not an isolated incident.
It's not even isolated as to Alec.
Yeah. Is that surprising to you, though?
No. I mean, again, really, watch the video. It's a great video. It's eye-opening. As the officer says in it, this is part of his job, this looking for big shit. And statistics show that far from this being an isolated incident, Bexar County officials were doing this to people all the time. Unfortunately, the law, it's not surprising. Because when you give officials the power to act like a law unto themselves, they run with it. And Bexar County recently tried to get out of the lawsuit that we have here, saying that they didn't have any policy of stopping people like Alex. And just a couple of days before the retreat, their motion to dismiss was denied, and that case is proceeding.
So, Rob, what are the other Fourth Amendment issues that IJ is working on?
Oh, well, there's a lot of Fourth Amendment issues that we're working on. I'm thinking about all of them. There's businesses. Obviously, many of you run businesses, and unfortunately, many businesses lack Fourth Amendment protections. About a few decades ago, created this thing called the closely regulated business exception, where if you're a closely regulated business, they don't need a warrant or your consent to come in. And guess what happened? Courts have ballooned the number of industries that fall under that exception. You remember Jeremy Bennett? He's the taxidermist from the video yesterday. Ohio made taxidermists subject to warrantless inspections. And as you heard, Jeremy was criminally charged just for asking the officer, the game warden, to come back when his shop was open. But thankfully, once we sued Ohio, things quickly changed. They immediately got rid of that regulation authorizing the warrantless inspections. As you heard, we were able to get Jeremy compensated for the money he had to pay fighting off that bogus prosecution. But, you know, likewise, we don't have a lot of protections in our land either. Unfortunately, that's due to prohibition. During prohibition, almost 100 years ago next year, the Supreme Court tersely held that we don't have any Fourth Amendment protections in our open fields, which is really any private property that you own outside of your home and the area immediately surrounding it. Now, so we made a campaign. We realized this has been around 100 years, so this is going to be a tough thing to tackle. We started with states, challenging the open fields doctrine or state constitutions, including in Tennessee, where we won a unanimous 3-judge panel opinion on that. And once we built that record in Tennessee and the other states, and we really honed our arguments, we're going to turn our sights on the Fed and take down that 100-year-old mistake.
So, what should the law around the Fourth Amendment look like, and how do we get there?
Okay. I know, I see that my time is short. I could spend hours on this. If any of you are interested in talking more about Fourth Amendment, please come talk to me. I love talking about it. I talk these guys' ears off about it. But the Supreme Court has said regularly, over and over, said that at a minimum, we are due the degree of security and privacy that the framers would have expected for themselves. And you know what? I think we should take them at their word. And that means to fundamentally rework the Fourth Amendment. And there's a couple of key areas. One is this idea of what's a search. A lot of things don't get any Fourth Amendment scrutiny because they're not deemed to be searches. So I want the court to get in, to bring all purposeful investigative acts. Whenever the government purposely investigates your person or property, that should fall into the Fourth Amendment box by using an intuitive idea of what a search is, the plain dictionary definition. And also, like, the other part is the only unreasonable searches and seizures are forbidden, are prohibited. And some people say, well, unreasonable, it's just, oh, let's weigh the government, my privacy rights against the government's interests. Guess who usually wins that one? Right? So what instead we should say is look back to the common law. If the common law wouldn't have allowed the police to do this, that's the end of the story. And if the common law doesn't have a clear analog, then they should say whether if the law enforcement can do this unchecked, whether that would undermine our security and our persons and property.
So one last question for you, Alec. Rob mentioned earlier that we won the MTD in your case on Wednesday. How did you feel when Josh called you and told you that?
It's very relieving to see that a judge agrees that a county should be held liable for what their officers are doing in the field. They said 9 times out of 10 is what happens to the customers. People in the field, like me, you know, 90% of the time they're wrong and don't find anything. That's a pretty bad statistic.
Yes, not great odds that. Yep. Well, thank you so much for fighting back against that with us, and we're gonna win.
All right.
Thank you. So next we'll talk about zoning with IJ client Chastity Decker from Idaho and IJ senior attorney Paul Avalar, who leads our Arizona office.
I always want to make sure I have a roof over my head. Cities should be doing it a lot more accessible and easy.
Zoning ordinances shouldn't reduce attractive living options. They shouldn't be making people homeless.
So, Chastity, I'm just going to hand it right over to you if you want to kind of share some words about your story.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. First of all, thank you so much for having me. I am beyond grateful to be here today. However, with that being said, I am completely out of my element and I'm terrified of public speaking. So I've written a few words to read to effectively tell my story without losing my train of thought. So back in 2019, I was in the process of having a custom tiny home built with the hopes of living a minimalistic lifestyle. During this time, my grandfather unfortunately passed away, so I decided to temporarily move from Nevada to Idaho to assist my mom with his estate. Turned out my time in Reno became much longer than expected, so when the completion of my tiny build came around, I moved it there into a local RV park and resided there with no issue. When the time came for me to finally move back home, and after months of searching, I found the perfect spot. It was on private property, on a private lane, that had the exact accessible hookups that I needed. The neighborhood even had another tiny home parked two houses down. So I signed a lease with the homeowner, and it seemed to be the perfect win-win situation for both of us, until code enforcement came knocking, literally the day after I moved in. He explained that by residing there, I was in violation of a city zoning code and was ultimately given only 10 days to vacate or rectify the problem. So in a pure panic mode, I desperately reached out to a tiny home Facebook group asking for suggestions. And the best advice I ever took was to do an article with my local paper, pleading for more time to find an alternative. Shortly after the article was published, I, as well as the homeowner, were both cited for minor vehicle registration violations. I can only assume in retaliation for the local article. However, I was granted a little more time to be compliant, only due to the publicity, but it still wasn't enough. It was at this time I learned that my article had fortunately gained the attention of IJ, who graciously came to my rescue, renewed my faith in humanity, and gave me the hope to possibly move back home.
So, Paul, she mentioned zoning. What even is zoning?
I am going to give you the worst lawyer answer of all time. It's complicated and it depends. It's complicated because people confuse zoning with some concepts that it's not. It's not nuisance law. It's not building codes. It's not even really city planning. Strictly speaking, zoning is a set of regulations enacted and enforced exclusively at the local level, not the state, much less the federal level, that govern how people can use their land. And use is a very open concept here.
And, I mean, the idea of regulating property isn't, you know, new, but zoning is relatively new. So how did we get here?
So, interestingly, until the 1920s, zoning law didn't really exist, and certainly not like we know it today. Prior to that, land use was really regulated through nuisance law, and nuisance law is this concept in the law, very old, that I have a right to use and enjoy my own property. But if my neighbor's use and enjoyment of their property interferes with mine, that I can take them to court, and a judge can say whether or not That's reasonable not. So for example, if I live in my home and next door my neighbor puts up a giant chemical factory, that might be an unreasonable infringement on my use and enjoyment of my property, and a judge could sort that out. So some of the earliest zoning codes, not surprisingly, really did focus on unreasonable or dangerous or incompatible uses, like no chemical factories in residential neighborhoods. Okay, easy enough. Unfortunately, zoning has really, with the Supreme Court's blessing, grown way beyond just basic health and safety issues and come to embrace all sorts of aesthetic or even moral choices, so that today, again, with the court's blessing, zoning doesn't just regulate where we live, it regulates how we live in a lot of ways.
And it, you know, does this enforcement pretty arbitrarily, as Chastity's situation shows. Chastity, you mentioned that there's another tiny home near yours that seems to be fine. Did you ever really understand why they came after you?
No. Not at all. That's still a question that I have, so...
Paul, the idea of, you know, keeping toxic waste away from, you know, residential areas or whatever is pretty reasonable, but it's a big leap from that to what's happening in Meridian, where Chastity's home is. So, you know, what's the effect of all of this?
Well, one effect that absolutely everyone agrees on, Republicans and Democrats and libertarians, liberals, conservatives and libertarians, California, Texas, each of the last three presidential administrations, everyone agrees that increasing land use regulations increases housing costs.
Chastity, did that kind of play out where you live? Did you see kind of the housing increase in Boise area? Have you kind of seen
prior
the effect
to
of that?
Moving back
home? Right.
Oh, definitely. I was definitely priced out of the rental market there and definitely out of the real estate market. But hence the reason I decided to go tiny. You know, it was the irony of it all was that I chose to go this way for many reasons, but mainly to ensure that I would always have a roof over my head. And here I am.
So, Paul, how widespread is this?
Well, sadly, Chastity is not alone. About 20 years ago, you could still find researchers, economists in this area would say, well, we get that increased regulations cause higher housing prices, but really these are limited to the sorts of pricey coastal areas you might expect, San Francisco, Manhattan, things like that. Today, with the growth in all of these regulations nationally, it's not a limited problem anymore. It's a national problem. And so, for example, in Sierra Vista, Arizona, we are representing Amanda Root and her neighbors. Now, Amanda owns her own trailer home, owns her own property, has her own trailer home on her own property. And the city came in during the middle of COVID and said, you have the wrong kind of trailer home on your wrong and the wrong kind of place. Where she lives is a former trailer home park. And yet they said, no, you can't live here. You have to move. Where do I have to move? Well, you have to move to the other zoned area that's 200 feet down the street.
Oh, wow.
So she can't even live on her own property in her own home anymore. And Amanda doesn't have a lot of money. This sort of forced move will essentially make her homeless, even though she owns her own land and her own home. Similarly, in Calhoun, Georgia, we are representing a group called Tiny House Hand Up. They're a nonprofit group. They are building tiny homes, smaller cottages to sell to people that are affordable. And the problem is that the city has a minimum square footage law that says every house you build has to be at least 1,150 square feet. For reference, that's bigger than the house I grew up in as part of a family of five. And the city says, we've done this because we want to make housing more expensive. We want to, in their words, keep the riffraff out. And you're going to be hearing more about this case later on today.
So how did IJ get involved in zoning?
Well, we've known zoning is a problem for a long time, but the IJ way is to not just run off and do things, it's to really think about them before we run off and do things. And so really we got involved when these issues overlapped with work that we were already doing and were already expert in. So Nashville, Tennessee, this is our client, Lidge Shaw. Lidge, you may not be able to tell from that picture, has a home recording studio. And in fact, the console you're looking at is the console on which the Eagles Hotel California was recorded back in the 1970s. Lidge somehow has it in his home recording studio. I still haven't figured out how he got it. As you might imagine, in Music City, home recording studios are ubiquitous. Everyone has them. But Nashville said that Lidge and people like him couldn't have clients, couldn't have people over to his home recording studio to record. He could have it, he could invite people over for free, but if they paid him, it was illegal. And so we've been suing over Nashville's restrictions on home-based businesses for quite some time. Also in Malden, South Carolina, we represent Jeremy Sark and Marie Doherty. They own a U-Haul rental facility. And the city came in and rezoned their area because private developers thought their business was ugly. And they said, you can't be here anymore. You got to go. You have to leave right now. And that's a violation of the takings clause. There's an idea in the law called amortization that says you can't just kick people out from their where they are if they've been doing it for a long time. And so we sued, and the city backed down immediately. It allowed them to stay, and so that's all to the good. But those are the sorts of areas where we really started sinking our teeth into this issue.
Obviously, there's a lot wrong with zoning right now. So what would good zoning look like, and how do we get closer to that?
There's, even though everyone agrees that zoning is causing some real problems, there's not a ton of agreement on how to address that. There's always entrenched interests, NIMBYs, leagues of cities and towns. And there's also a fight right now between, like, well, should zoning be kept local or should the federal government get involved in zoning? And at IJ, the response to bad government regulation isn't government regulation at a different level. It's individual rights. And so what we're really litigating to do is protect people's ability to use their own property in ordinary, harmless ways that they've always had a right to be able to do.
Chastity, you said earlier that the city enforcement officer is kind of threatening you, and I know at one point he threatened you against filing a lawsuit. So what gave you the courage to file this case?
You know, I didn't sign up for this. all I really wanted to do was just live peacefully, a simple life in my tiny home, and life had other plans. But I feel it's I'm optimistic about it because I feel that really good things are going to come out of it.
Well, thank you so much for coming to talk with us today, and thanks for fighting back against this egregious zoning.
Thank you so much.
So for this last segment, we're going to talk to two different IJ clients who have very different cases, but they both revolve around this core issue of innocent people being punished for things that they didn't do. So we'll talk with IJ client Debbie Brummett, who used to live in Granite City, Illinois, and Robert Jones from Pasco, Florida, along with IJ senior attorney Sam Gedge. So, Debbie, what was Granite City like when you first moved there?
We were on a dead-end street. It was nice and quiet. Nobody bothering us. We had the train behind us. It was a little bit of noise from that, but we got used to it. It was fine.
But things changed in, I think it was around 2019. What happened?
My daughter and her boyfriend decided to borrow a van from the parking lot of a national rent-to-own. And they were stopped for that borrowing and said that they were going to my house and then taken to jail. I didn't know about that until 2 days later. And 3 days after that, I got a note saying that my landlord had to evict us because of their actions.
So this kind of doesn't make sense, right? Somebody else did something, somehow you're being evicted. Did you ever have a chance to kind of explain, you know, you didn't do anything wrong, what was going on here?
Yes. So immediately after receiving that, I started looking online, trying to figure out what do we do, because this is crazy. I found nothing except the steps to answer the call and So we started that process, and we were going in front of a judge person, and they would make a decision. And so we did that about a month later. And then shortly after that, we got a letter saying again that, yes, you're going to have to be evicted. So we've instructed your landlord to do so.
So, and you spent hours and hours kind of trying to sort this out, and they ultimately just didn't care about what you had to say?
Didn't care at all. Didn't matter.
So, Sam, how can this even be a thing?
Well, it's a terrible thing, Kim, but it's all too common in Illinois, where Debbie and her partner Andy were living, and throughout the nation. It's euphemistically called a crime-free housing law. And I think when most of us hear that, we think, well, this sounds good, right? We like housing, and we like things to be crime-free. But in reality, these kinds of laws were kind of systemic compulsory eviction laws. And Granite Cities, I think, is one of the most egregious examples of that. The way it worked, as Debbie's experience illustrates, is that if you lived in rental housing anywhere within the city, private rental housing, not public, and anybody who was a member of your household or who city police thought was a member of your household was charged with committing a crime anywhere within city limits, they might be arrested, which is fine. They've committed a crime. But city police would then force your landlord to evict everybody involved, everyone in the house, you know, whether or not they were involved in the crime, whether or not they knew about the crime, you know, whether or not the crime took place in their house or across town. It really was just ultimately an experiment with collective punishment. And it was exceptionally common in Granite City. Over the 2010s, about 500 of these compulsory eviction demands were issued to mainly innocent people who just happened to suffer the misfortune of knowing people who may or may not have committed crimes somewhere within city limits.
So turning to Robert, you've also experienced harassment at the hands of your local government. So tell us a little bit about that.
My name is Robert. I'm a father of four children. And my oldest child, who was 14 at the time, the incident had gotten in a fight at school. And unfortunately, I had to move schools, and that was in a different county, to keep him going to a decent school. I didn't want him to go to a secondary school because of a mistake. Go to this place, I'm thinking it's a better school, life is going to be good. Well, the sheriff's department from that county spoke to the other county, and within days of me enrolling my kid in the new school, I had officers show up in my house. And in the beginning, they tried to tell me, you know, we're parents, we're here, we heard about your kid, we want to do the scared straight moment with him, let us speak to him. And I'm not anti-police at all. I mean, matter of fact, at the time I was going to school to be a paralegal. So I allowed them in my home, and then 18 officers just ransacked my place. I let them in to talk to my kids, and then I'm trying to get them out of my bedroom, out of my closet. They got flashlights. There's 18 of them. They're in my daughter's room. They're in my son's room. So I corral them out of there. They leave. I'm happy. Everything's fine. I'm thinking maybe the kids got to talk, but at least nobody's arrested. 3 days later, cops show back up while I'm at work. They arrest my son. They claimed while they were there, they found three empty sandwich bags that contained trace amounts of marijuana. My son goes to JDC, gets kicked out of school. We fight the charge. Literally, the attorney that I have, not an IJ attorney, gets the case dismissed because there's zero weight of any marijuana in any of the bags. That seemed to piss the people off. The cops came 22 people deep the next day, and they claimed that my son had burgled somebody's house a couple blocks away. They stuck him in JDC another 21 days, and this continued to happen. But that wasn't it. After he was sent away, they kept coming to the house, and they kept wanting to harass my family. Even when I was at work, they'd bang on the windows and doors. My 12-year-old daughter and 10-year-old kid, son and 8-year-old daughter would be home scared. They'd be on my property banging on the windows and doors and saying, hey, little girl, we see you in there in the closet. You know, tell us about your dad. Who's the guy that comes over in the BMW? And they were relentless. I mean, they were so relentless that after I was able to hire or get IJ involved, the records show that they had come like 2,200 times in 365 days. And we know this because every officer that came by got paid. And the truth is, that first time that my kid went to JDC and they tried to charge him with that marijuana, that was the only time they ever charged him with anything. So you got a kid that's 14 to 15 that does all these 436 days in JDC, 21 days at a time, with zero convictions and zero arrests. And then they're throwing me in jail because I'm refusing to let them search my house. And they continue to come by and arrest me for things like overgrown grass violations or the jet skis being too close to my house or cars parked too close to the road. And the truth is, normally in ordinance violations, you can fight. But what happens when they decide not to give you the ordinance violation, make a mandate court date, never give you a notice, and then come back later after the judge, you don't show up, and they mandate a warrant for your arrest. So now they're coming by the house. Instead of just harassing me, they're arresting me for failing to appear to an ordinance violation I had no notice of. It happened about six times before I finally moved. IJ got involved 3 years later because there was a reporter that did a report because 42 officers from that sheriff's department got fired and turned around and sued the department because they were tired of arresting innocent people. And the truth was, I had left this 3 years ago. Like, I was scared. I'm glad I didn't have a record. But the truth is, at the end of the day, they were doing this because they have a targeting program. It's an intelligence-led policing program. It's a point system for regular people, non-felons. And they created names that, like, prolific offender. And prolific offender, you know, normal layman would think that somebody who had been arrested over and over and over or convicted of something. Well, their definition was very vague. Anybody that had been arrested once. I mean, my kid was arrested at the school for fighting. They call that an arrest. If anybody in your household was convicted of a felon, anybody that's on the emergency contact list when you sign your kid up to school that's supposed to sit in the emergency box in the office, well, they have a resource officer who's the sheriff's department. And instead of putting that in a box in the office, they scan it to a system. And that system runs an algorithm check based on names. Any names that's emergency contact or affiliated with that child gives the child points. And IJ was able to find out that from the research that this was almost specifically targeting children and creating criminals. Because let's be honest, you put a 14 or 15-year-old kid, incarcerate him for about 400 days, and do you think he's going to come out an astronaut? He's not even going to come out a high school student. Yeah. They won't let him back.
Sam, can you tell us about some of the kind of constitutional issues that are going on here? Like, this system is so convoluted.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of problems with both of these ordinances. I think one of the most surprising coincidences that I learned about over the course of these cases is that the police in Granite City, Illinois, would go to very small conferences with the Pasco County Sheriff's Office in Florida and, like, come up with these just completely nightmare scenario ideas of how to abuse innocent people. But I think, as with Granite City, you know, Robert's experience in Pasco County starts with this kind of benign, euphemistic program, right? They call it intelligence-led policing, and as with crime-free housing, right, we want our policing to be led by intelligence. But it really did, I think, become almost a Minority Report-style program, if you all remember that the Tom Cruise movie from the early 2000s, where they're basically trying to identify future criminals or people who might commit crimes in the future. As Robert said, they're often targeting children and parents of children and people associated with children. And I think there's a lot of, you could, like, go through the Bill of Rights, and it probably violates most of the provisions in the Bill of Rights here. But I think one that we can focus on, which is a thread for both of these laws, is the First Amendment, the right to association. So when we think of the First Amendment, oftentimes we think first of free exercise of religion, freedom of speech. We're going to talk about that more later today or tomorrow. But Supreme Court precedent also says that the First Amendment secures a right to associate. to associate with members of your household, with loved ones, with friends, and to do so secure in the knowledge that the government can't punish you, can't target you, simply for the act of associating with people who they don't like. And what we see in Granite City and in Pasco is really police, turning that principle on its head, where they're using, aggressive code enforcement or, mass eviction in the case of Granite City, basically as pretexts to just get rid of people who they don't think are good for the community. In Granite City, for example, there's a catchphrase they like to use, which is that criminals are like weeds, and we have to pull them up by the roots. And I think that's a really dystopic way of thinking about it and really kind of says the quiet bit out loud almost, because the roots we're talking about are innocent people. And innocent people who have really important property rights in their homes or living safely with their families. And, that's one of about 17 different constitutional problems I think we could talk about.
So, Debbie, what was it like for you when IJ got in touch with you and got involved in your case?
It was a relief. I could breathe. I could breathe again.
And Robert, what are you trying to accomplish by fighting back against Pasco?
I mean, to be honest, I told you guys I ran. I was scared. I was lucky to get away with my family, what I thought would be unscathed. But I think this whole thing has to do with the reality of if this continues to happen, what happens next? Now, I mean, they're allowed to bang on your windows and doors when you're not home. They're allowed on your property. I mean, if you get a chance to watch some of the body cam video, there's plenty of it out there. It'll make you sick. It'll make you sick to think that, the kids that you spend all your time trying to get ready for the future, try to teach them the police are good, you try to do all these things, and you get a sheriff's department, right, that has changed their motto from to serve and protect to we fight as one. And I think that right there, it just tells you the gang mentality that they're creating for themselves, because they've been doing this for 7, 8, 9, 10 years under the same sheriff with nobody fighting against them. So they feel more and more and more empowered. And if this case was to lose, how much more empowered and emboldened do they get? And without IJ to stop them, there is nobody else. Believe me. I mean, they're the government. They print their own money. I don't know any other attorneys out there that are able to do that. And it's the truth.
So, Sam, can you tell us a little bit more about, in Granite City, kind of where that case stands now?
I would be happy to. So it's been going on for about 4 years now. We got involved on an emergency basis in Debbie's case. Her landlord reluctantly had already issued, the first step of an eviction notice because Granite City Police said that he would be fined if he didn't evict Debbie and her partner Andy and her two grandchildren who were living with them. Within a couple of days, we got an emergency order from the federal court, so they were able safely to stay in their home as long as they wanted to. They've moved across the river to Missouri since then. But we're still fighting the case. We've gone up to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago once. We're back down in the district court. For people who enjoy, federal jurisdictional esoterica, there's a lot of it in this case. I'm happy to bend your ear about it if you'd like, and not if you would like me not to. But the fight's going on. For us and for Debbie as well, I know it's not so much that, Debbie is, needing to stay in her home anymore. She's moved. But, there are lots of other cities out there in Illinois and Minnesota and California and across the nation that have laws like Granite City's and that are operating with impunity. And so, for us and I think for Debbie as well, that's the real motivating force for why we're keeping the fight going in this case.
Well, thank you so much to all of you for coming and sharing these awful experiences. And I think we all look forward to, smacking these cities down a little bit. So, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Just stay here. Yeah. Since IJ's founding, property rights have been essential to our mission, just as they are essential to a free and prosperous society. This morning, we highlighted a few of the, ways that IJ is challenging these egregious and just truly abhorrent government actions. And these areas are on the cutting edge of property rights litigation, but they're not the only areas where IJ will deploy our hard-won expertise. In the coming years, as governments attempt new and increasingly creative ways to invade our property and our privacy, IJ will continue to uncover these issues and take them on. And together, all of us will beat back this government overreach and ensure that private property rights receive the most robust protections in court. Thank you.